Thank you for listening to Psychedelic Parenting, a service of Awakening Families. If you like what you hear, consider a tax-deductible gift to this work through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, or use one of our Amazon links when you're buying the things you need.
Want to share with their young people the grandeur and the glory that they are encountering.
What's really important is the felt presence of direct experience. We have to stop consuming our culture. We have to create culture. Create your own roadshow. Nexus of space and time, where you are now, is the most immediate sector of your universe.
Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. This is the 33rd episode of the podcast, a very auspicious number, and it comes to you on an auspicious date, April 19th, or Bicycle Day, which commemorates the anniversary of Albert Hofmann's first deliberate experiments with LSD on April 19th, 1943. As the effects began to come on, Hofmann left his office and rode his bicycle home. The holiday was invented in the 1980s by my fellow Midwesterner, Dr. Tom Roberts. Today is also the beginning of the 2017 MAPS Psychedelic Science Conference in Oakland, California. I would love to be there with all my dear friends, but finances have prevented me from attending. I wish all in attendance the best of times, and I commend them for their efforts to change the public perception of psychedelics in America and worldwide. If you're interested in being a part of what's happening long distance, please join me in watching the live stream from the symposia stage in the marketplace area of the event. You can find links to the stream in the program notes of this podcast or by going to symposia.com. I would also like to formally announce a couple of upcoming events that we at Michael Meditations are putting on in Jamaica and invite you all to join us. First, we still have slots available for our next retreat, May 17th through the 24th. I will be rejoining my soul brothers, Omar and Eric, in Jamaica for the June 14th through 22nd Psychedelic Families Retreat. I will be giving a talk on reclaiming religious freedom and family values, and we invite you to bring your loved ones for a chance to experience deep bonding and healing on the shores of Treasure Beach, facilitated by us and potentated by the mushrooms themselves. Finally, we would also like to announce our very exciting upcoming Psychedelic Specialists Retreat. This event will feature four mushroom experiences facilitated by Omar, Eric, and myself, as well as humor by the hilarious Shane Moss, who will be just coming off his multi-city psychedelic-themed A Good Trip comedy tour, and an in-person presentation by my dear friend, former guest, and the director of the NYC Psychedelic Education and Continuing Care Program, Dr. Catherine McLean. This will be an event not to be missed and is limited to only 20 participants. Information about all these events can be found at www.mycomeditations.com. That's MycoMeditations.com. Finally, without further ado, I would like to introduce today's podcast guest, Shane LeMaster. He and I met Halloween weekend at the Detroit Entheogenic Conference, which is hosted by our friend Kalindi E. And we thought that it may be interesting to have a conversation here today. Shane is currently at the MAPS Psychedelic Science Conference in Oakland, California, which unfortunately I was not able to attend. So he's going to give us his input on his experiences at the conference, as well as talking about his own work in martial arts and in psychology, and how we can use and how he has used his own psychedelic experiences for what he calls reverse parenting. So helping his parents break through their own social conditioning and changing stigmas around psychedelic use. So Shane, welcome to Psychedelic Parenting.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in psychedelics.
Okay. Initially I got introduced to psychedelics in my teens. I was around 15, and previously I had not had any experience with any substances, no alcohol, no tobacco, no cannabis. And my very first experience with any substance was actually LSD I took a full dose of LSD while on a field trip at my military school. It was at an amusement park, and it was mind-blowing, to say the least. We played laser tag all day and rode roller coasters, and ever since then, I've had a significant interest in expanding my own consciousness, and that's what really kicked off my interest in studying the mind and the capabilities of the human mind and human potential.
And so, what got you interested in coming to psychedelic conferences?
My interest in psychedelic conferences beyond my initial use was recreational for sure.
Sure.
But after I got into the field of psychology, I chose a field which is sport and performance psychology, which is what I have my master's degree in.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explore human optimization, performance enhancement through the power of the mind, and I actually heard a story about Doc Ellis, the Pirates pitcher who pitched a no-hitter in the 70s on LSD, and that story really inspired me. And since then, I've been really interested in pursuing, I have a master's degree right now, I've been very interested in pursuing a PhD or getting on some sort of research team to study microdosing.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically microdosing's effect on human performance with specific domains towards, increasing focus, increasing pain tolerance, increasing physical capabilities such as strength and physical endurance, as well as mental strategy, cognitive processing, and things of this nature. My own athletic background is pretty extensive, but currently, I'm a competitive martial artist. I do mixed martial arts as well as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at the national and world levels.
Wow.
And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a very, very interesting sport in that it's considered much more of a mental sport than a physical sport. It's very physical, maybe one of the most physically taxing sports out there, but about 80% of it is mental, in which, you need to strategize. It's almost like playing chess, but with your body. So you're thinking multiple moves ahead. You are taking in inputs, not only sensory, but visual,
mm-hmm.
And having to be very creative with your ability to defend attacks as well as set up attacks with your opponent. And I've been doing self-experimentation with microdosing in this sense, both in training and in competition, and I'm finding great results for myself, and it's something that I'd like to get some actual evidence behind and get some studies done, not only to help athletes or performers or performing artists improve their performance, but I feel like these skill sets can translate into the greater population and definitely help improve performance in any area, whether it's family life, parenting, academics, sports, surgery, uh-huh. All sorts of things like that, any performance domain.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Have you met my friend, Paul Austin? He's he's the creator of The Third Wave. It's a website on microdosing.
Paul and I have been in email contact, and he's recruited me to write a couple articles for his website.
I'm glad. Have you met him?
Yeah.
He's there in Oakland right now, I think.
Yeah, he is at the conference. I haven't run into him yet. I mean, the conference right now has over 2,800 people.
Wow.
So it's a lot of people to kind of meet, but
yeah.
I have not run into him in person.
Yeah, I think you guys would have a lot of stuff to talk about.
Definitely.
Obviously, if you're planning on writing some articles for him, cool. It's a cool thing to see. Like to be able to, know all these different people and like connect like-minded people in the community and see them get connected. And that's, I love doing that. I love being involved in that. It's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about this concept that you were mentioning as we were kind of prepping for this, which you said is reverse parenting. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't have any kids myself, and I know that your podcast is highly oriented towards psychedelic parenting. And since I don't have any kids myself, you know, since we met, I've given a lot of thought to this concept and how it applies to my own life. And this concept of psychedelic reverse parenting, to me anyway, you know, it's a reflection of, well, my mother, she deals with addiction, has her whole life, as well as suicidality, things like that. And, she grew up in an era, in a generation in which the anti-psychedelic propaganda was very strong, and the cultural conditioning really affected, a whole generation. Mm-hmm. And so this reverse parenting idea is, you know, really just about helping our parents, helping our family members who have been conditioned unfairly into believing that psychedelics are more harmful than good, and really breaking that stigma and showing them that psychedelics can be very beneficial for dealing with their issues, specifically for my own life and for her life, you know, breaking her longstanding cycles of addiction, as well as, her suicidal ideation, which is still very, very prominent in her life.
So tell me about your own story of overcoming addiction, because I have a similar story that many of my listeners have heard lots of times. So,
yeah. I have the genetic component because both of my parents were addicts and alcoholics. Mm-hmm. So I developed alcoholism very early on, right around the age of 16, about a year after I began drinking. You know, I was already full-blown alcoholism, which later translated into, you know, addiction to methamphetamines, to cocaine, to prescription opiates. I was training for Jiu-Jitsu World Championships one year and blew my knee out completely, and was just loaded up with prescription opiates, and the doctors just mismanaged it. They didn't wean me off correctly, just cut me off. Mm-hmm. And that re-triggered my addictions. Wow. So I dealt with my addictions for a long time, and it ended me up in some really dark places, you know, getting in trouble with the legal system, having my own suicidal ideation at times. And, I've been in inpatient treatment, and it was my inpatient treatment experience that actually brought me through it. And I've been sober from alcohol now for 8 years. Thank you very much. And because I've been clean, my life has completely turned around. I never would have thought I would have been as far as I am in my career, in my life, or my spirituality as I am now. Mm-hmm. And to me, life is all about potential right now. And I'm just trying to take full advantage of that. And I believe that my own psychedelic use has definitely helped me maintain my sobriety, along with, my own therapies and my own group experiences, whether it be through AA or NA or just talking with other addicts, and also watching my family members still deal with addiction, helps me to maintain my own sobriety. You know, I'm also a licensed addiction counselor, so I do the work every single day of my life in that context too.
And how would you say in the wider community of addiction counseling is an openness to the utilizing of psychedelic medicines?
Well, at this state, in my home state of Colorado, and with the clinicians that I surround myself with, or that I'm surrounded with in my practice, there doesn't seem to be, very open-mindedness about the use of psychedelics in addiction treatment.
Does not, you said?
Yeah, it does not. Seems like a lot of them still hold on to their cultural conditioning and their stigmas. It's very difficult for me to be able to even talk about this topic with them for fear that I'll be stigmatized again, and that, I'll be reported to the licensing boards or something, and my license will be stripped away. But there's so much great research out there, as evidenced by what I'm learning here at this conference. Right. And, it's something that needs to be brought out into the public eye again.
I totally agree. And, if I guess it's a pretty good picture that if you coming from Boulder, Colorado, don't feel like there's much awareness or support for these treatments there in what, you know, most people would consider a very progressive liberal community. It's the picture is probably a lot bleaker for people in many other more sort of red parts of the country, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually from Fort Collins, Colorado, but,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And Boulder's not very far away. It's about an hour and a half away.
Oh, you went to school in Boulder, right?
Yes. Yes. I'd say the Boulder community is a little bit more open, mm-hmm. but still there's still that, cultural conditioning down there as well.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah. And, you know, I've talked to people before about like that have family members who are in law enforcement, for example, and like, well, they get angry at their relatives for, you know, having these ideas. And I said, well, you know, you can't really blame them when they've been their entire, like, especially in law enforcement, all of the education, so-called education that people in law enforcement get when they go to like, you know, classes to get CEs or something like that. It's still all this like backwards false information, and it's presented to them as if it's fact. And I think in some situations, in the sort of mental health community, there's a similar kind of thing like that. And especially in like addiction treatment and stuff like that, I feel like the philosophy of like 12 steps and the sort of total sobriety kind of thing tends to permeate that stuff. And, you know, and I've had in personal interactions where like someone sort of perceived the fact that I use psychedelics as like, oh, I've just traded one addiction for another, not really understanding how how it works. And, you know, this isn't about like it's not like Suboxone. I'm not trying to like stave off my addiction with ayahuasca or something like that, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. But there's, sure, yeah. You can't blame people if they don't have a sort of access to the newest information.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had my own issues with the way, the 12 step programs do it. You know, we're finding now in some of the new addictions research that, you know, the opposite of addiction is really not abstinence, like the 12 step programs promote, mm-hmm. but instead it's connection. It's connection to yourself. It's connection to others. It's connection to, a higher power of some sort. Mm-hmm. And really that's what I get a lot out of, psychedelics is reinvigorating that connection with myself, with the spirit, with others around me, with my community. And mm-hmm. that really plays a crucial role in getting sober and staying sober.
And this is an interesting thing when you think about it, how there's definitely in the 12 steps, there's definitely a spiritual component. You know, you have to like surrender yourself to a higher power. And when the way that sort of many 12 step programs are, especially like, you know, ones where you're sort of court ordered to attend to these things, there is, you know, a reluctance to make it religious, so to speak. But, you know, if the experience there almost requires an experience of, you know, loss, ego loss or selflessness, and to kind of, you know, kickstart the experience. And when we sort of, if we try to like sort of make it secular or something, then we lose access to that experience in some ways. And the thing about psychedelics is that, you know, many people have shown already that they reliably induce mystical experiences. So it seems like the perfect medicine for kickstarting, say, the 12 steps. But you have to be able to be open to the idea that not every kind of substance that you consume is like a bad drug.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it, you know, even one of the founders of AA himself was a huge advocate for psychedelics. And, you know, that's discounted a lot in current 12-step programs.
Right, yeah. Bill W. was really interested in using LSD to, you know, kickstart the 12 steps. And he actually worked with Aldous Huxley in the idea of creating a AA clinic. And that whole thing is really laid out interestingly well in, can't remember his first name. His last name is Latin, and the book is called Distilled Spirits. He talks about the relationship between Bill W. and Aldous Huxley. It's a really cool book. I read it.
Now I'm gonna have to check that out.
So tell us about what's been what you've been experiencing at the conference. Give us a rundown of how things are going there and what you've learned and who you've met and all that fun stuff.
Oh man, this conference is so amazing. I've been to many, many academic conferences, none for psychedelics. This is my first major conference for psychedelics. Like when we met, obviously I'd been to the Detroit conference, which was much, much smaller.
Yeah.
But this MAPS conference this year has over 2,800 people, over 200 presenters, over 200 volunteers that are here running the show every day and doing a fantastic job. There's three different tracks this year. There's the plant medicine, the interdisciplinary track, as well as the clinical track.
Mm-hmm.
And just lectures nonstop for the last 3 days. And, you know, there's so much to see here. You know, it's difficult to get to see everything you want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, MAPS is broadcasting every single session on their website as well as on YouTube, so we can go back and anybody who's out there listening right now can access all these talks that have happened. You know, it's fantastic. From the lectures themselves, I did a holotropic 2-day workshop with Stan Grof himself before the conference even started. Yeah, it was amazing. Had my own visionary experience through that. And I hope to integrate that into my own practice as well. I'm also taking part in an integration workshop after the conference here. And, uh-huh. you know, there's the marketplace, which has poster sessions. It has vendors. It has artists. They've had psychedelic comedians.
Mm-hmm. That's our friend Lex Pelger, who is our most recent guest, is the host up there.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I came to this conference with a few specific intentions. One was to try and seek out a PhD program that would accept me, given my specific research interests. Another was to promote my own ideas for my research interests and try and get some of my ideas out there to some of the bigwigs in this profession to see if it's a valid line of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, lastly, it was to meet my heroes. To be my heroes in this field. And I can't tell you enough, you know, how synchronistic this conference has been for me. I met everyone I wanted to meet within the first day of the conference, and not in the traditional settings that I usually meet people at conferences, which is, you know, you wait for their lecture to be over, you wait in line, and you maybe get 5 minutes to talk to them.
Well, uh-huh.
I'm meeting most of my heroes at random places. Like, I met James Fadiman just walking around the lobby of the hotel and talking to him about my interest in microdose research. And he gave a lot of validity to my ideas for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Spending multiple days with Stan Grof in very close proximity,
uh-huh.
Talking to him in person and having him sign my books. I met Alex Gray for a second time here and had him sign my books and talk to him about his work.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite people that I met here was a comedian, Duncan Trussell,
mm-hmm.
who I never would have expected to be able to meet with him face to face. But, he reached out to me after seeing that I wanted to meet him and, pulled me aside for, 2 hours. And we just sat and talked by ourselves about the future of psychedelic research, the future of these performance enhancement applications, how they're mm-hmm. being used right now, and
mm-hmm.
it's just been so amazing. I've met everybody I've wanted to.
Good for you, man.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been amazing. One of the most amazing experiences of my life so far.
That's great. Yeah, I've also have found personally that being on the conference circuit and, you know, I think back to the person that I was in 1999 when I took mushrooms for the first time and how, you know, I just listened. I devoured everything that I could find at that time by Terrence McKenna. And if I had known back then that my, 40-year-old self would know all of these people whose writings and art and things that I was devouring at the time, I'm not sure if I would have believed it. You know, it's pretty awesome to have these, to meet these folks. And I found almost without failure that there are many of them are very humble people and totally willing to nurture the next generation of thinkers and explorers and researchers. I'm totally indebted to Dennis McKenna and Rick Doblin, David Bronner, you know, so many people, Robert Barnhart, who have just like made me feel like the stuff that I'm doing is important and have like encouraged me to flower, you know. So I'm glad that you have had that similar kind of experience. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, that's, you bring up a good point. And like I said, I've been to many academic conferences for many different topics, and you know, and a lot of these academic conferences, you know, you meet some of your heroes in these various fields, and you go and talk to them, and you know, they almost talk to you from their own pedestal that they put themselves on, and they almost talk down to you, and
right.
You know, it makes you feel very excluded. But here at the psychedelic conference, it's so much different. Like you said, everyone I've met who I've, you know, had this affinity for has been very humble, and they talk to you at your level, and they don't treat you like you're less than anybody. You mm-hmm. know, we're all equals in this, and that's a very strong characteristic of the psychedelic experience itself, is mm-hmm. that you learn that we are all one, and that nobody's better than anybody else, and it just feels so good. It
yeah.
feels so good.
Totally. So, tell me about your interest in using microdosing for performance enhancement.
Yeah. So, like I said, my background is in sport and performance psychology. So right now in my private practice, since psychedelic use and psychedelic therapy is still kind of underground, I haven't integrated it into my own practice, but I do intend to in the future. So right now in my private practice, I work mostly with, you know, definitely a strong mindfulness base. I'm a Buddhist myself, so I've gotten a lot of great results in applying mindfulness techniques to improve my own athletic performance. And like I said earlier in the podcast, you know, I've experimented on myself with microdosing, particularly LSD. Microdosing in both training and in competition mm-hmm. for jiu-jitsu, and I'm finding very good results as far as really attuning my focus, calming my mind. You know, in my sport in particular, if you're in your mind and you're thinking about the moves, you're already a step behind, and you're already putting yourself in a dangerous position. So really trying to get yourself into this flow state, into this the state of being in which there's no thoughts, but you're just reacting. You're letting your body do its thing. And I'm finding great results with the microdosing as far as being able to, you know, think multiple moves ahead, strategize, and have very, very real physical performance enhancement. So I feel stronger. I feel more flexible. I feel faster than my opponents. The psychedelics, this idea that, you know, time seems to slow down. It's really apparent. So when I'm in competition on these microdoses, you know, it seems like my opponents are moving so much slower than me, and I'm able to react so much faster than I could when not under the influence of these microdoses.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. And like I said, I believe that these applications go far beyond the sporting context. So you know, applies to work right now. You know, we're seeing lots of anecdotal reports from Silicon Valley as far as how it's helping people improve their cognitive abilities and their abilities to problem solve complex problems. And really, I just want to take that to another level and see if we can get some actual evidence. Right now, there's no actual evidence that microdosing even works.
Right.
It's all anecdotal stories, and I want to be that person that that helps to bring about that evidence so that we can nail it down and say to not only our psychedelic community, but to the public at large that, hey, you know, these doses, which are very low risk for any sort of psychological or physical side effects, these small doses have very real and profound effects for enhancing human performance and the human mindset, and hopefully move us towards a more collective, empathic society.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm really interested in when I meet people like yourself who come from either a military background or martial arts is this idea of, like kind of warrior ethos. A number of my friend Omar Thomas, who's a partner in the Michael Meditations retreats in Jamaica that we do, is a retired veteran. And Kalindi Ee, who organized the conference where we met, is a martial artist. And so I'm interested in hearing about your take on the kind of the way of the warrior and how psychedelics fit into that.
Yeah. So I don't know. I've always been a huge fan of warrior cultures. It's kind of a little hobby of mine to study warrior cultures alongside my actual physical martial arts training.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I find that the warrior lifestyle, as you may term it, is amazing in and of itself, with or without psychedelics. You know, learning self-discipline, learning this ability to control your emotions, control your body, to protect others who can't protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've studied samurai culture, I've studied Spartan culture, I've studied Greek fighting cultures, I've studied Viking culture, I've studied all sorts of warrior cultures across time. And, you know, actually, I'm finding in my own research into these things that a lot of these cultures in the past have used psychoactive substances to sort of improve their own warrior spirit, their warrior ethos, whether mm-hmm. it's the Vikings eating Amanita muscaria before they go into battle so that they feel less pain, or the Native American Indians of the United States eating psilocybin cubensis to improve their abilities to hunt and mm-hmm. pick up animals in their peripheral. You know, I talked to Kalindi at length about this at the Detroit conference, and, you know, I asked him, you know, what sort of benefits do you see coming out of using these psychedelics for your martial arts? And he talked to great lengths about, you know, harnessing your chi and the ability to connect to yourself on a whole nother level. And not only connect to that chi, but really learning to manipulate your own energies so that, you know, you can be most effective, not only in the martial arts, but in life in general.
Yeah. Right on.
And, So there's an interesting book, a couple books on this topic, but, Buddhism and Buddhist warriors and psychedelics, is a strong interest of mine. And there have been some previous books published on this. I suggest it to any of your readers. I can't, think of the titles off the top of my head, but, you know, you just pop it in Google as Buddhism and psychedelics. And
yeah, there's a really interesting book that just came out by Mike Crowley. It's called The Secret Drugs of Buddhism.
That's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting one. And on the Western esoteric side, too, is my friend Chris Bennett from Vancouver, who has written lots and lots extensively on the history of cannabis and religion. And his book, Cannabis and the Soma Solution, has a whole middle section that's all about kind of cannabis in ancient Judaism and Christianity. So it's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that one out. Yeah, so I'd like to ask you a question, Jonathan.
Sure.
And you know, I was hoping that you were going to be here at the conference. What prevented you from coming out here this time?
Well, I've gone through some interesting kind of personal struggles this year, and my finances were not really in the place where I felt like I could comfortably come to Oakland. And then also my kids just had their very first play performances that they've never been in place before. And my wife and I were both really active in theater when we were young people. And so this was the weekend of their very first play ever. So I really couldn't miss it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds amazing. You asked me before the podcast if I had any kids, and I don't have any kids right now, but I do have, you know, very high hopes and desires to have, you know, upwards of 4 or 5 kids eventually. Uh-huh. And just the stories that I hear you tell on your podcast about family life and what it's like to be a father are really inspiring really motivating. And the insights that you provide as far as, you know, how you integrate your own psychedelic journeys and experience, with parenting, but also how you mitigate, the parenting experience. And, you know, there's a very that's another thing with the addictions field too, is that, you know, if you get, you know, say your neighbor knows that you're using psychedelics and they turn you in or something, you can lose your kids, right, essentially. Yeah. And you talk about, you know, how you mitigate that risk to protect your family and protect your kids, not only from the negative information, but also from, you know, the damaging effects of what some of these stigmas can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Of what people, when people don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the best advertisement that we can be for the power of these things is just to, like, be the people that we are without shame, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have stories like you have, like I have, about overcoming, you know, strong years or decades long addictions, and just being able to, like, say, like, I'm no longer, I don't consider myself to be an addict. I don't mm-hmm. feel like I'm in recovery anymore. I feel like I'm not an addict. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing to be able to say, and say honestly. Because I don't feel like I need to, I don't really drink alcohol. I mean, you know, I have, like, the last year I've probably had like 3 drinks or something like that. And all of them were in, you know, either I was traveling abroad and felt like I needed to taste one of the local, you know, when I was in Prague, I had to have like one absinthe. I didn't feel like I could leave mm-hmm. Prague without an absinthe. And I had it with friends, and all it did was confirm to me that I don't like the way that I feel when I drink alcohol, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think it's pretty awesome to be able to, you know, just like, well, I can have one drink and it's not a big deal. I'm not, like, sort of enslaved by my sobriety and or by my addiction anymore. It's the, like you were saying, the opposite of addiction isn't necessarily complete sobriety, but, you know, connection to what's important. And if you have a drink and you recognize that it's, I don't really care for the way that direction that substance takes me, then you don't have to, you know, I don't need any more because I recognize that's not the road that I need to go down.
Yeah. And you talk about this idea of, you know, being who you are, and, you know, you've talked about it before in some of your podcasts about kind of coming out of your psychedelic closet. And,
yeah.
And, you know, that's something that I've personally been toying around with and trying to build up the courage to do myself. And this is actually, probably the initiation of that process is doing this podcast with mm-hmm. you. Previously, you know, only my closest friends know that I've even used these substances. And, you know, as an addiction counselor who's licensed, you know, it can be very, very challenging to, I mean, you want to come out, you want to express these things to the world, but also you're putting your career on yeah. the line. You're putting yourself at great risk for harm, not only with your career, but jail time.
Sure.
And, you know, it's very inspiring when you talk about that. And, you know, I was actually looking at some of the statutes that go along with being an addiction counselor. And, you know, in the statutes, it says, you know, if you have an active addiction to a substance, you should report it, or you should not be doing the work. And, you know, what you said earlier is, you know, it's so such a misconception that, you know, that you can have an addiction to psychedelics. It's
right.
In my mind, it's an impossibility to have an addiction to these things, because it's not the type of substance that you want to take on yeah. a daily basis. You know, it's something that it takes a lot of courage. You have to build up the courage to, you know, to take that handful of mushrooms or something like that. It's not something that you necessarily your body craves. It's something you have to force down your throat.
Yeah, there's nervousness and trepidation every single time you do it, and you really do have to, like, steel your nerves and, you know, make yourself eat the mushrooms or, you know, smoke the DMT or whatever it is that you do. You have to, like, really, like, psych yourself up to do it. Yeah, every single time. It's Shane Moss said in his stand-up mm-hmm. show, A Good Trip, he was talking about this very thing of, you know, whether you could be addicted to psychedelics. And he said, you know, every time I eat mushrooms, I'm like sitting in the corner sweating, staring at them. And I have to keep, and I have to just force them in and say to myself, take your lessons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, given with the actual statutes and the laws around this my profession and what it says about addiction and substance use, you know, I think for the most part, you know, I would encourage others to take steps to try and come out gradually, mm-hmm. and just know that, you know, you are protected at some level, that, you know, it's okay to use a substance if you're an addictions counselor, as long as you're not abusing the substance,
right.
and, you know, legally you're protected. So, you know, come out slowly, surely, whatever you're comfortable with. But, yeah, I do feel, like you said, it's very important, for our culture and for the profession and for, the psychedelic community that more people come out and speak towards the positive efficacy that can come from the use of these things.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
And especially when you've had such a profound experience of healing of addiction using these substances, it's like, how can you not tell people about it? Or somehow you just feel like you have to tell people about it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And there's been some really great talks here at the Psychedelic Science 2017 about that. And one of them that really impacted me was, you know, it was about MDMA primarily, but about all psychedelics and how the restriction of the use of these substances by our government, you know, they think that they're doing us a favor by restricting these things, but really they're preventing hundreds of thousands of people who are suffering with PTSD and with depression, with suicide and things like that. And, you know, without access to these medicines, these people are just being left out in the cold to die with no support, no help. When, you know, you and I know that these substances can bring these people out of the shadows and show them that there's light and there's value to their lives. It's really, you know, it's a disservice what prohibition is doing. And this prohibition, even though the supposed morality behind it is to save people's lives or save people from overdose, it's really killing a lot more people than it is saving, I think.
Oh, yes, definitely. Or, you know, at least, even if it's not killing people, the there is definitely, you can see the, in terms of like, quote unquote, lives ruined, more lives are ruined by prohibition, especially cannabis. So many people is like who go to prison for their, you know, 5-10 years, mostly people of color, who, you know, then they're felons for the rest of their lives. Or when they get there after going to prison for, you know, smoking a little ganja, then they meet real criminals and get involved in the criminal underworld, because once you get out of jail, if you're a person of color who's an ex-con, you can't really get a real job. So you end up involved in crime, and all because someone, you know, smoked a doobie.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's really sad. And it almost brings tears to my eyes to think about all the damage that's being done. You know, in my practice, I deal with a lot of addicts, but I also deal with, you know, clinical psychology issues as well as sport and performance stuff. But, yeah, I have quite a few clients, even in the state of Colorado where cannabis is legal. I have quite a few clients who smoke cannabis and have kids, and because their neighbor smelled marijuana and they disagree with the practice, you know, they turn these people into social services. And in a state where it's recreationally illegal, these parents are having their kids stripped away from them, you know, put in foster care, being seen by the system as unfit parents. Even, you know, when at the state level, it's completely legal, and this stuff is still going on. And these, like you said, these parents' lives are being ruined, and they come to see me for therapy. And, you know, I feel helpless at times. Like, there's nothing I can do. I don't agree with the system as well. And the best I can do is provide them with support, mm-hmm. and, you know, inform them that what is happening is unethical and not fair, and just be on their side and try and give them the hope that, you know, they will get their kids back if they keep trying. And it's just so sad to see these families' lives being ruined by people's ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's totally. And I mean, even in the state of Michigan where I live, we have legal medical marijuana, and it's still totally legal for an employer to deny you a job or fire you from your job for testing positive for cannabis, even if you have a prescription and you have the card that's issued by the government. I mean, think about that. I have a card that's issued by the government that says a doctor said that I can use medical marijuana for medicinal purposes. And yet I could, you know, go to try to get a job at the grocery store and test positive for marijuana. And they can say, well, we choose to not recognize your card as a valid reason for you to fail this drug test. But if you apply the same thing to opioids, where there's a horrible opioid addiction problem in this country. And if you have a prescription for Vicodin or Suboxone or whatever, OxyContin, that's fine. You'll fail the drug test for opioids, and then you'll say, here's my prescription. They'll say, okay, welcome to your job at the grocery store bagging groceries. But if you fail, if they have the exact same situation with cannabis, it's like, well, we're not going to hire you because it's cannabis.
Yeah, exactly. I'm seeing that too in Colorado, especially with nonprofit organizations that are funded by government stipends, university jobs. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of their funding from the government. They're still very restrictive on cannabis use of their employees. It's almost impossible to get a job with any of these people if you imbibe cannabis. And you know, it's such a shame.
Yeah, I've heard that the NSA and FBI and stuff have had a real hard time finding good cybersecurity people to work for them, because they like everybody fails the pot test.
Trying to hire hackers for their own purposes, and everyone's failing. Mm-hmm. And yet, how many government workers are probably on prescription opiates, like you said, and being allowed to have their finger on the button to nuclear weapons and the fate of not only our country but the fate of the world. How many politicians, how many senators, how many congressmen, how many people in President Trump's administration
opiates? Did you see all that sniffling in those debates? That guy is probably using some coke.
Sure. I mean, it's so hypocritical.
Yeah.
And that's a question I have for you is, you know, what do you think we can do to, we're doing our best we can to bring out the facts as far as psychedelics and cannabis into the mainstream and help shift people's perception. But on the other end, what can we do to also illuminate the hypocrisy that's going on and illuminate the overuse of the more dangerous substances, the overuse of alcohol? Yes. Oh my goodness. I met Dr. Nutt while I was here, and of course his famous study on the dangerousness of substances was illuminated once again. And you know, the abuse of alcohol within politics and government is rampant. And how hypocritical is that? And how can we bring attention to that?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's just a matter of whether it's I think personally I'm kind of in the place right now where I think that people just need to start running for office. I think I agree with what the sort of movement that Bernie Sanders is trying to start in the wake of his failed campaign is just to get progressive people that have new ideas into places of elected office. I mean, right now in Lansing where I live, we're fighting against the movement of certain people in the city council to kind of put our local cannabis dispensaries into, kind of ghettoize them. And basically the new zoning ordinances that they have proposed would make it basically only about six of the like 25 or 30 stores that we currently have, only like six of them would survive these ordinances they're trying to create after they've approved all these places and given them licenses to operate and everything. The solution now is just to elect new people who represent our values. And I think that that's the big thing is like, if you're a person who cares about these things and wants to make a difference, it's just, you got to like go out there and, run for office or find the people that are out there that are running for office and and, you know, be a part of whatever is next. I think I see my work in with this podcast and at Myco Meditations as kind of being like culture hacking. Like, I feel like my job is to raise my kids with the view that these medicines are sacred and that they're here for us from the divine to change the world for the better. And, you know, some people don't agree with us, but we're going to change the world anyway. And we can do that by raising our kids with the values that we preach and by living our lives by the values we preach and being the kind of people that other people will say, well, what is it about that person that makes them so alive and electrified and kind? And, well, it's because I had this amazing experience with this fungus or with this, you know, Amazonian brew or with iboga that totally changed things for me. And this is why I do the things that I do, and, you know, come check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point that you bring up, and it's been a topic of conversation that I've had with some of the people here, you know, on the breaks in between lectures. And it's been a big topic here in general is, you know, this new administration with Trump, and you know, I've heard so many people ask, you know, do we think that it's possible in the future for these ideas to change and for the administrations to change their ideas on these topics? And, you know, it's my belief that, you know, politics is a profession that is predominantly dominated by an older generation, you know, and by older, I mean, you know, 50 plus.
Right.
And it's these people. And I'm not saying that, you know, all people of this generation are closed minded. I'm definitely meeting tons and tons of people here. Actually, probably about half the people at this conference are over 50 and just interested in psychedelics. But the people in politics who are of this generation that have been brainwashed by the propaganda, you know, we just kind of have to wait until they are forced out of office or that they leave office, and that more people from my generation and your generation kind of work their way into these political positions, that they get the courage to step up and run for political office, right, and then get in there, then that's when we can really start making some changes.
Right.
You know, I see our generation is so much more open-minded. You know, we are almost denying the cultural conditioning that our parents got.
Yes.
You know, we're presented with the same propaganda, but we're wise to it now. And we're saying, you know, what you're saying goes against my own experience.
Right.
And my experience, you know, takes precedence over, you know, your value system and your belief system that you're trying to push on me,
right?
Because it's more real for me. And then once people of our generation get in there, I really do think that there's going to be some significant changes and some significant progress made, hopefully in our lifetime. You know, the hope is that, you know, psychedelic research and psychedelic therapies and psychedelic use recreationally becomes at least decriminalized in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Sort of like the, you know, I applaud Portugal for their decriminalization efforts and not sending people to jail for substance use, but instead sending them straight to treatment.
Right.
And it's funded. And these people are getting great results. You know, the recidivism rate back to substance abuse is so low there,
mm-hmm,
and it's working. You know, why can't we adopt these models yet?
Right.
And I think, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to become wise to that. We're going to start saying, you know, this is really working, and it's worked a while for Portugal and for other countries who are adopting the system.
Yes.
And I think it can work for our culture as well.
I very much hope so. Yes. Well, looks like we're about at the end of our hour, Shane. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Psychedelic Parenting, for giving us the lowdown on what you've been learning at Psychedelic Science 2017. I wish we were there. Thank you. Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing more about your work in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Jonathan. It's been a true pleasure, and it's been a pleasure getting to know you since the Detroit conference.
Yeah.
And I wish you the best of luck in your future podcasting and the Myco Meditations. You and I share a mutual friend who has also been down there, and he he raves and rants all the time to me about the benefits that he's gotten from these psilocybin retreats.
Oh, good. Yes, he's a dear soul, and hope to maybe get him on here sometime. And I hope to maybe see you sometime in Jamaica.
Yeah, I would love it. I would absolutely love it.
All right. Well, have a great day and enjoy the rest of the conference.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan.
All right, bye-bye.
My advice is to learn from your children, and perhaps eventually, when you're spiritually ready, you'll turn on with your children if you think that's the right thing to do.
Your friends and your associations.